Welcome to this week's Kesterberis Podcast with a K, available on Kesterberis, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo.
I've been thinking, guys, maybe we should do an a cappella version of the theme tune sometime.
I'm in.
James?
You should keep thinking about it and perhaps say it less.
James is in. He just doesn't want to admit it.
Well, you're out because you didn't even, you could even done it in a different key when you said I'm in, but you didn't.
Damn it, you're so right.
Oh dear. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's a podcast for the K. My name's Christian Corley. With me are James McLean and Brian Terranova. Big thank you to Gareth Cavanagh, who stepped up last week when James, Brian, and myself couldn't find a time to all speak together at the same time. Made for a very interesting podcast last week, guys. So we discovered how to set up a con as well, which is an invaluable piece of information for any Doctor Who fan who's interested in setting up a convention, I think. So again, thank you to Gareth for that. Now, hey, exciting stuff. This week we've got a ton of exclusives because Brian, last week, one of the reasons he wasn't able to join us for the podcast is because he was going to Comic Con. Isn't that right, Brian?
No.
What do you mean no?
That's not right.
What?
I wasn't at Comic Con.
Where the hell were you?
It's a tad far away, don't you see? America is vast.
So you didn't go to Comic Con.
Well, okay, look, I'm here, right? This is the East Coast. Comic Con was West Coast, right? Ordinarily it's only like a 20-minute drive, I'll grant you, but I was busy.
Right.
Yeah.
So we don't have any of those interviews with Peter Capaldi.
No.
Or Jenna Coleman.
No.
Or
I could fake them.
Sean Pertwee?
No.
David Bradley? None of them. Right, okay.
No.
Well, we'll talk about Comic-Con anyway, because there was a Doctor Who trailer. Are you guys seeing the Doctor Who trailer?
Yes.
James McLean, have you seen the Doctor Who trailer?
I have indeed.
Yeah, okay. Dear listener, have you seen the Doctor Who trailer?
Yeah, I haven't.
Well, just in case you
it's
haven't.
It's amazing how that one listener has such a problem with his tonality to his voice.
I think it was some distance away. Shall we, we'll just watch it now, okay? Slightly longer pause.
Every time I think it can get more extraordinary, it surprises me. It's impossible. I hate it. It's evil. It's astonishing. I want to kiss it to death.
Doctor, and I save people.
You.
What took you so long, old man?
That's the trailer. Interesting experience you're going to get from that, dear listener. Is that you're only going to be listening to it, you're not going to be seeing it. So you're going to be able to focus a little bit more on the dialogue, which a lot of it seems to have upset people than taking it out of context. Which seems, this is a trailer. How many Doctor Who trailers have you seen? You can't expect everything to be as you expect. What do you think of the trailer, though? It's quite cinematic in scope, isn't it?
I think, you know, as usual, I had a lot of nice visuals and so on. And I guess it does what it's supposed to do as a trailer. I mean, obviously, we're going to watch the episodes anyway, you know, but there were a lot of good, I thought, alien visuals and seemingly alien landscapes, which gives me a little bit hope that we're going to get out the hell off Earth for a little bit.
But, yeah. Always a good thing.
Yeah.
Okay. McLean.
It's a good trailer.
It's a good trailer, yeah.
Kill the Moon had a good trailer, didn't it? So,
Kill the Moon had an exceptionally good trailer. No, you're absolutely right, yeah.
So that's the problem. it's a very good trailer. So it doesn't really tell you whether it's going to be a very good series, though. So, yeah. It's got people talking, as usual.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's half the job, isn't it, really, for a trailer? Especially
Comic-Con. What would be a series of Doctor Who without people wondering whether it's Romana or the Rani
or Susan
coming back before it or Susan?
I was hoping we'd get there.
Yeah. Well, you know, in last week's podcast, we had Bonnie Tyler as Susan in a kind of 70s rock Doctor Who scenario. One of those crazy little conversations Gareth and I decided to have rather than in private, we had it on air. There you go. There's a lot of trailers at Comic-Con, and you know, it's par for the course. You're gonna get trailers, you're gonna get exclusives with comics and stuff. So the Doctor Who, the people are still talking about Doctor Who beyond Doctor Who fandom is a good thing. We'll maybe talk about some other exclusives and trailers that have been released at Comic-Con a little bit later. Just one of the visuals in there does appear quite similar to a city from a certain 1960s episode of Doctor Who. So
the Daleks.
Yeah, that one. Yeah. Do you think that's an intentional?
Hasn't that been a spoiler for a while?
Well, we don't know, do we? Because it's just rumours, isn't it? All of it's just rumours. We don't really, really know. But the reason I mention it is because it's a Dalek. It appears to be a Dalek city, as per the Daleks. But it's a different Dalek city to the one we saw in Asylum of the Daleks.
Well,
push into that historical Dalek context again, wouldn't it?
Well, it is, because there is that historical Dalek in the later shot, isn't there?
Hmm.
In the background.
In the background, yeah.
Which would sort of make sense, because who is it? Was it Capaldi who was talking about stuff about the 60s?
Yeah.
Coming up in the a slight homage or respect to the 60s. So I'm assuming it is the Daleks.
It's also good, too, because it's one of those things that, you know, I've always kind of wondered about the show. They generally always see the Daleks or a threat like that in some sort of chronological order, except for probably Genesis of the Daleks. And I understand that shot you were talking about with the classic Dalek, and it still had a new Dalek, and that's fine because they have time travel capability, so it still works for me, you know. So it would be neat to see them kind of revisit that way, if it truly was a past rather than
it's
like
strange that they've never done
thing.
That before, I think, with the Daleks, because if any race is going to be tinkering with its own history, it's the Daleks, surely, in order to make themselves stronger.
Or even just to change their past failures.
Yeah.
Wasn't there a fan video, a YouTube sort of fan video, which was very well done, which had the Daleks going back to interfere?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't seen that. Sort of, if you can find a link to that, I'd like to see it.
I'll have to try and find it. It's not a bad one. It's a singular new series Dalek having to go back and interfere with their history.
Right.
Back in the Daleks, and it's all the CG effects.
I'd like to see that too.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. And it's interesting that kind of that parallels with my recommendation, which we'll get to later on, a film in which that kind of thing happens, which you can probably all guess what it is. But now, listen, there's another thing which is related to Doctor Who and Stephen Moffat. There's a. Do you want to do the Sherlock trailer?
No.
No.
Hey, okay, well, knock yourself out.
I kind of do. Because, well, yeah, let's have a listen to the Sherlock clip.
This needs a 70s laugh track.
Mr. Holmes, I do wish you'd let me know when you're planning to come home.
I hardly knew myself, Mrs. Hudson. Had some trouble with dismembered country squires. They're notoriously difficult to schedule.
What's in
Laugh
there?
Track.
Never mind. Thank you.
Did you catch a murderer, Mr. Holmes?
Caught the murderer, still looking for the legs. I think we'll call it a draw.
And I noticed you published another of your stories, Dr. Watson.
Yes, did you enjoy it?
No.
Laugh track.
Oh?
I never enjoy them.
Why not?
I never say anything, do I? According to you, I just show people up the stairs and serve you breakfast.
Well, within the narrative, that is, broadly speaking, your function.
My what?
Laugh track.
Don't feel singled out, Mrs. Hudson. I'm hardly in the dog one. The dog one?
I'm your landlady, not a plot device.
Do you mean the Hound of the Baskervilles?
And you make the room so drab and dingy.
I'll blame it on the illustrator. He's out of control. I've had to grow this moustache just so people will recognise me.
Laugh track.
Now, how are they going to sustain that level of high-quality comedy for 60 to 90 minutes is what I want to know.
Well, that's it. It feels like a 70s... sitcom.
It feels like a comic relief.
Yeah.
7 minute sketch to me.
You're just waiting for the the canned laughter to keep popping in after.
I was waiting for the phone number and the message across the bottom asking me to give generously, and telling me what Shirley from Carlisle had donated.
I mean, they've screwed themselves over quite righteously, because is getting more and more likely that from various sources that there's issues with Series 3. Series 3, is it Series 4
four.
Now?
Four.
Series 4?
Yeah.
About Series 4 ever being made at the rate it's going with the various problems with sort of aligning cast, money, interest, etc. That they'd have been better off making sure that the Christmas special responded to the Series 3 and then, you know, they're open to Series 4 however they want to take it. But... Mm. I mean, right now, especially if Series 3 is, if the Christmas special is a come down. And to be honest, it's not what people want. I mean, this is the problem, is that when you generate a show which runs its success on people's interest within as much the stories as the characters, each series has a knock-on cliffhanger. Mm-hmm. You get to a point where if you don't deliver that, people are going to feel frustrated.
Yeah,
no one has asked for a period version of Sherlock. To them, it's not Sherlock. They want to see their Sherlock.
They want to see Sherlock Holmes. They don't want to watch someone doing a bad impression of Jeremy Brett.
Well, that's it.
I was just going to say that's exactly what's putting me off about it. First of all, I thought season 3 was a pretty mediocre season of Sherlock. To follow it up then with a classic Sherlock setting. It just seems wrong, considering the success of the show. The interest of the show is the modern day take on it. And then you take that away with the only episode we're going to get probably for the next 2 years after waiting 2 years again. It's like, what are you doing? Why bother? Puts me right off, essentially.
Now, admittedly, we don't know what the makeup of the episode is. It could be that there are, contrasting... more than one mystery in it. It could be like it's broken up into small parts that are set in different eras. We don't really know that much about the episode. But based on what we've been given in there, that is a very contentious clip.
But I don't know. As much as I've sort of grown to dislike the show, I feel for... the people who do like the show, and they're going to end up with something possibly, unless it does, as you say, have some contemporary link.
I can't see how they could do it without a linking device, but then again, I really didn't expect to see that kind of knowing dialogue in there, so...
Well, that was the other problem, is the dialogue felt as if the show was so amused with its own... Hmm. sort of textual references to the disparity between the classic and them that it didn't feel like it was taking itself seriously. It felt, as you said, like a comic relief clip, as if you were meant to know that this... I think the problem is it's running on the idea that the audience knows that this is not Sherlock as their real Sherlock. And because of that, the show constantly responds to that But the problem is, by responding to it, they're automatically sort of making a sort of derivative of Sherlock. So, and I think that causes a discord with the audience because they don't want their show lampooned. They want to see their show.
Yeah.
So I will say, though, there is one way that it could potentially work. And this is going to take us back to kind of a Doctor Who link. And it was Doctor Who and the Pirates by Big Finish. When people heard that Big Finish was doing a Doctor Who musical, they were, you know, some of them liked the idea. A lot of them were really up in arms against the idea. But when you actually listen to the story, it's actually the Sixth Doctor kind of recanting to a child what had happened, because he's trying to explain to him, I believe, what happened to his mother, if I'm not mistaken, the story. And he's trying to kind of keep it lighter so as not to just like tell this horrifying tale in full detail. So he kind of tells it as a Pirates of the Penzance kind of musical story. So there's potential that either Watson, which I would doubt Sherlock, but it's possible, but there's potential that Sherlock is maybe trying to tell somebody something horrible that happened and kind of, you know, making it a tale, and maybe not the same situation, like maybe not as personal, but maybe making it like, well, let's tell this tale as if it was olden times, make it a little easier for you to be separated from it. So it could start off in the modern day Sherlock times, and maybe it's just, maybe it's a book Watson is writing about their tales rather than his blog anymore. So there's potential ways the setting could work, but if it just outright starts and is in that setting and is an entire Sherlock adventure set in that era without bookends of any type in the modern day era, it's going to seem wasteful.
Yeah.
I think there's also a danger that it becomes something which lampoons the original, when there is actually quite a lot you could be lampooning about Sherlock, the TV show. It feels almost like, you know, pick not quite comfortable from the clip that you're going to spend all your time mocking a book when your show is far from perfect itself. Or maybe I'm wrong then. Maybe it won't, and maybe it'll play lots of mocking jabs at its own show. But then even then, is that what audience wants? You know, I don't know. Again, as you say, Brian, it depends on how it sits in context with the rest of it.
It's, right.
But from the trailer, it doesn't make you feel like it's particularly respectful to the audience who, you know, keep it going, or the books that it derives from, but maybe wrong.
I think you could easily have swapped Armstrong and Miller, or Mitchell and Webb, or Harry Enfield and Paul Whitehouse, or any number of comedy duos, Markman Wise even, into that sketch. Two Ronnies, into that sketch. Yeah, you know, that's how it appears, into that scene, and you wouldn't have noticed the difference.
Yeah.
Except maybe the Markman Wise one would have had a bust with a little movable jaw. Mark and Wise fans will get that. So we'll leave that there. Sherlock trailer is a little bit disappointing. Doctor Who trailer's intriguing and mysterious, and I want to kiss it to death. So Brian, you didn't go, did you? Damn. There was another Doctor Who trailer. Are you guys interested in the other Doctor Who trailer from last week?
What other one?
There was another Doctor Who trailer.
Oh, that one?
Yeah. I'm quite excited about
it. Is this going to be called the podcast with a trailer?
It might well be, yeah. Well, we can't... I would love to share the Blake 7 I Have Been Subjugated clip with people, but because there's no dialogue in it, all it is the I Have Been Served theme tune. So we can't really do much with that on the podcast. As good as the Are You Being Served theme tune is, we can't really do much with that. So look, this is going to be a massive thing when it comes out. The Lego Dimensions Doctor Who component. And hopefully we're going to have a bit more about this. I mean, I'm hoping to open discussions with certain parties about Lego Dimensions. So let's just have a listen to this, because it's quite intriguing.
Come on, don't just sit there. You've got a bunch of monsters to meet.
Who are you? What did you do to us?
Is he always like this, Wildstyle? This is a TARDIS that travels time. I've met you three before, but you haven't met me yet. Can someone explain to me what's going on, please?
Really? I didn't mean friend.
You will tell us everything you know about the Doctor's plan.
All of time and space. Whenever, wherever.
It's your choice.
So, yeah, Lego Dimensions is coming out late this year. It's £85 in the UK. I'm not sure how much it is in the USA. And then there's the various level packs, of which I think, as I understand it, Doctor Who is one. There's others. But the Batman and Gandalf characters that you heard there and Wildstyle from the Lego movie are in the game already. There's Homer Simpson. There's a Back to the Future pack. There is a Portal pack. And the Portal video game. There's several others which are going to be like £30, £25, £30 as well. So it's going to be quite expensive. But if you're just going to stick with one character, then Doctor Who fans have got a lot of Doctor Who stuff to do in that game, which is kind of exciting. Now, Brian Turnover is not the best person to ask about his opinion on video games because he doesn't play games. Doesn't really know very much about them. So, Brian, what do you think of that clip?
It was fine.
It's kind of cool that Peter Capaldi and Jenna Coleman and I believe Michelle Gomez have done voices for it.
Who was the one that said, "We're friends of the Doctor"?
That's the Wildstyle character from the Lego movie.
Man, you can... Oh. Sorry, I hated the pronunciation on every word in that line. That's how I felt about the trailer.
Have you not seen the Lego movie?
No, I haven't.
No, it's not bad. It's okay, actually. It's a lot... I thought it was going to be really, really bad, but it actually turned out to be quite clever. So I was happily surprised there. We're not going to basically, dear listener, not going to deny that this isn't a very Doctor Who filled podcast because there isn't an awful lot of Doctor Who to talk about that isn't Comic Con. And you know, we could sit here and ramble about how cool it was that Peter Capaldi met Sean Pertwee and had a photo taken, but firstly, they already know each other, and secondly, you already know that's cool and you don't need us to tell you how cool it is. So I'm not going to sit here and kind of get excited about something that we all know is absolutely awesome.
Well, okay, what's about the recent thing with Stephen Moffat calling Twitter the worst possible form of audience research?
Oh, well, I was going to do that later. Do you want to do that now?
Well, you hadn't mentioned it earlier and you were saying we're running out of Doctor Who things, so not knowing that you had planned a golf of non-Doctor Who to have a Doctor Who thing at the end.
Well, I just wanted to do the Star Wars thing first, but if you want to do the Stephen Moffat thing now, we'll do the Stephen Moffat thing now.
Well, it's up to you. It's up to you. It's your domain.
Okay, well, I don't have anything to cue for this one, so it's my domain.
It is.
It is, you're right, I own it. Just when you say it's your domain, it's like, oh, I own this entire domain. Obviously, he meant an internet domain, not an actual physical realm domain. Yes, yeah, Stephen Moffat's revealed that he thinks Twitter is a useful tool for promoting a show, but the worst possible form of audience research. People on Twitter are having fun, they're making gags. It's like overhearing a pub conversation. When you're at a pub, do you tell the truth or do you try and get attention? I don't think it's a good idea to go to the pub with Stephen Moffat, basically, based on that. So, I mean, Twitter isn't a great way of measuring any form of of reality, I don't think. But, I mean, how do you feel about this, James?
I don't remember anyone saying that Twitter was. I think that's what I find a bit of a... It seems to be essentially a knock at Twitter, really, rather than responding or responding to a current trend of thought. He just understandably doesn't like Twitter, and he's giving you a reason. Well, you know, if you consider Twitter a way of deciding what audiences thought of Doctor Who, that's a pretty bad idea. And you think, well, yeah, but you could say that fan letters written to Doctor Who are a bad way of audience research, which they would be, but no one is suggesting that you use them as audience research. So it does seem a bit vague and doesn't really address anything.
Do you know how many active Twitter users are in the UK?
No.
Guess.
Five.
There are 10 million active 10 million active accounts, apparently, this year.
10 million and one.
Okay. Now, last year, the UK population was 63 million, based on estimates. It may be higher than that, but the official figure is 63,489,234. That's for last year. That means he's... And obviously, that's just one-sixth of people on Twitter. Now, obviously, it's a much smaller proportion of those Twitter users are Doctor Who fans. Probably 0.1%. So the ridiculousness of the whole concept of using Twitter as audience feedback and audience research is just highlighted there, because more and more people have realized that Twitter is, as useful as it is, it tends to be a focused echo chamber where people get more and more overexcited about the most stupid, trivial things. And
well, this is,
let's be fair, that's the internet completely.
Well, no, I think because Twitter is more focused in that. I think when you've got something like Facebook, as annoying as Facebook can be, when you're having a conversation, there's an opportunity for other people to get involved in conversation and for that conversation to be more like a conversation that you'd have in real life. But with Twitter, it's just voice after voice after voice shouting into the wilderness, and then you get some idiot retweet something that's either very, very useful and insightful, or utterly, utterly stupid. And those two things, possibly a little bit alluding to what Moffat says, those two things get focused, and it is that's why people have been describing it as an echo chamber.
I think there's two issues here. His issue isn't the echo chamber. What he's basically saying, he's calling out people on Twitter and saying, you think you represent this program and you don't, is really what he's doing here. That's the justifiable, maybe passive aggressive element to this comment, which he knows, and that's what he's, and he can have reason for saying that. At the same time, I think you've got to be careful that Twitter does have an impact, because the rest of the media governs itself around Twitter to a large degree. So what echoes come through Twitter can then be perpetuated through echoes through mass media. So those very small isolated opinions can actually carry a lot more weight than they would in any other format or in any other form. So in a sense, Twitter is actually an extremely powerful echo chamber for singular voices, which for any product is a bit unnerving, really, because it can affect opinion.
Yeah, I think as well the ease with which
they would in any other way.
The ease with which tweets can be embedded into newspaper websites,
absolutely.
Possibly is cause for concern for any franchise or show runner.
Yeah, so I think he has genuine reasons to actually say, "Hey, you lot think you are more important than you are," but then at the same time, he will be aware that lot are more important than they are by the whole echo chamber effect. And so it sort of works in both ways. They don't represent all of Doctor Who, but their singular voices can be amplified very easily and to quite a powerful extent. So yeah, it swings both ways.
Indeed, indeed. Okay, so Brian, have you any thoughts on that?
No, not beyond what you guys have already hit on. I mean, honestly, aside from what I said, the internet, period, because it's partially why I've been taking such a massive break from a lot of fandoms, because the forums, even Facebook, everybody, that it's like you said with Twitter, it's so easy to tweet one thing and just, you know, rehash that thing by retweeting it over and over again. But it's the same thing I see in forums, Facebook, and anywhere else you might talk about TV shows. One person says something and everybody else just rolls with it. If you come in with something that's different, even something as actually factual, that you're correcting a mistake they have, you're wrong just because everybody else on the internet is right. And it's tiresome, and it's something I've walked away from. You know, I think there are valid opinions on any one of those platforms, including Twitter. But, you know, like James had said before, you can't use that solely as your basis for opinion on the related material, I guess. I don't know. I think there are better things they need to do. For me personally, it should still come down to ratings, but it shouldn't just be TV ratings. They should take into account Netflix repeat watching. They should take into account the BBC iPlayer streaming, any kind of people who TiVo or DVR or whatever those shows. I don't know if they count as actual watches because your TV is technically still recording it. And if they're not, well, they should. You know, all of those things should be taken into account. This way, TV shows that are actually worth it and ones people are watching but not sacrificing their life to sit there in the hour that it's on should be taken into account for the lifespan of a TV show.
Okay. It's interesting that you mention ratings there. There's a lot of stuff going on at the BBC with the government at the moment. The government wanting the BBC to change its focus and to stop chasing ratings, which is a kind of a phrase that's been repeated. Now, the interesting thing about that is there's a Conservative government telling the BBC to stop chasing ratings. Where are we? What year is it? 95. So 23 years ago, they appointed a man called John Burt to the position of Director General of the BBC, whose job was basically to make the BBC more responsive to make use of external production companies, you know, those things with the radiophonic workshop and the model unit and all these little portions, the costume unit and stuff like that. They got broken down and sold off under his watch, or the beginning steps of those things happened under his watch, and forcing the BBC to be more competitive and to chase ratings happened. So it's interesting how this idea has come full circle, that a Conservative government instigated the BBC becoming more competitive, and now they want it to be less competitive. Which is where this whole rating scene comes in. How are you feeling about these things at the moment, James, with the BBC?
I do tend to feel that there is a political agenda going on, which is always a shame. Beyond that, I don't know. There are issues. I mean, like for one issue that I have, and it's one that I personally benefit from, is that by law, if you don't watch live or scheduled television, you don't have to have a TV license.
Currently.
So you can, currently, yes. So you can watch iPlayer, providing you don't watch live sports or live shows, and that is legal. You know, the downside to that is you've got a lot of people paying for iPlayer through the license fee, who are effectively funding other people in the same country watching something for free, which, you know, there are factors in trying to fund the BBC which do feel a bit offset. I don't subscribe that this needed to be. I think that they needed to change how the license fee was funded. I think the BBC is an institution that the government should be promoting, and you hear too many rumours of people within government suggesting that they'd like to see it smaller, would like to see it changed, or would like to see it gone, to make it feel that this is a legitimately objective approach. which is a shame, because I'm sure there are ways to structurally improve it. But, you know, are the motivations truly to help the BBC, or are they there for other facts? I don't know, honestly. I'm not these people, I couldn't say, but I do. It would be a shame if that is not the, if it is the case that they're not there to help. They're there to revise to their own, to a political agenda, whichever party it would be. I think that's a problem.
Yeah, I think there's an argument that certain parts of the BBC need to be reworked. I think there's I've seen an argument that local newspapers are suffering because of the BBC's local web pages, but because of the BBC website. And I think there is an argument that the BBC website gets cut back a little bit because they're obviously pioneers in a lot of online stuff over the past 15 years, but other areas have caught up. And they've kind of trailblazed a lot, and it's maybe time for other parties to be able to get involved in that, which they can't do because people just go to the BBC automatically, rightly or wrongly. And that does provide, essentially, that's a state-backed monopoly, isn't it? Which isn't great for competition.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's if we're going to, you're getting that place where the monopoly starts stifling innovation and stifling other businesses, which isn't ideal situation. It kind of, it's, things get a little bit unbalanced there, but yeah, on the whole, it's a worrying turn for the BBC. I've even seen the suggestion that BBC Worldwide be sold off, which is that'd cause all sorts of trouble, wouldn't it?
Probably. Yeah, that
licensing,
that does surprise
contracts.
Me as well. You'd think that would be the one arm of the BBC that you would want to push forward, but
yeah, yeah. Indeed. Well, it's not going to happen immediately or overnight, so we'll no doubt come back to that in the near future. Let's move on, because we've still got this to do, and then we've got recommendations. There's this other trailer that's come along in the last few days, which I think is kind of more exciting to many people than the Doctor Who trailer. And this is probably the event film of the year, even though there's competition from Batman and Superman fighting each other, and Mission Impossible and The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Terminator Genesis. This is the movie to watch in 2015. Some dialogue soon. But this is the Force Awakens trailer that was released at Comic-Con last week.
Real sets.
Here we go.
Practical effects.
You've been here, but you don't know this story.
Nothing's changed, really. I mean, everything's changed, but nothing's changed. That's the way you want it to be, really. To see the way the technology has evolved, and yet keeping one foot in the pre-digital world.
It couldn't be more exciting. It's still surreal.
We are here on day one of Star Wars Episode 7.
Yeah, yeah.
How incredible is that?
I can die now.
All right.
My whole life has led to this moment. I'm in heaven.
I think we've worn the suit out probably quicker than we expected, because every time you meet someone, they just want to hug it.
Getting back to the old days, the old ways of doing things.
JJ's trying to make sure these movies have a physicality to them. We truly are out in a desert, a real desert.
Star Wars. I'd burn for Star Wars.
And I'm just gonna bring this character to life.
You don't get to build an X-Wing every day or a Millennium Falcon. Every day I come to work smiling.
Energy and action!
You
gonna have to pause, take a breath, slow down, and really not freak out.
In the same room as all these legends and with all these new people who I'm sure will go on to be legends themselves.
You know, it's being done with such love and such enthusiasm from everybody, and I think that you'll be able to feel that coming off the screen.
It means so much to so many people.
You just know what it's going to be like in the cinema.
Star Wars is an important part of everyone's history. It's a beautiful thing to actually be involved in it.
Now that's a 3-minute trailer. And the most interesting thing about it is not what's in it, but what isn't in it. In terms of what they've essentially done is give us a load of behind the scenes stuff with an utter smidgen of new material, and yet everyone's gone absolutely wild for it. Which is absolutely ingenious. Brian, how do you feel about it?
You know, I watched it just kind of, you know, I had a kind of similar feel to a lot of things lately where I wanted to see the movie, but I was really just going to make up my mind at the time. I wasn't getting super excited. But after seeing the trailer, it did get me excited. And I think the main thing that got me excited was the focus on the real. You know, they're using so many actual monster makeup effects, actual sets, and actual spacesuits and so on. And of course, there's going to be CGI, and I'm sure they're going to enhance some of those sets and possibly even some of those creatures. But that means that you're using it the right way. You're enhancing what you've got. You know, you're not relying on it heavily. But the main thing that got me was it's a behind-the-scenes trailer, and it was the first time that there was something new Star Wars-related since Return of the Jedi, I will say, that got me excited, feeling, wow, this is Star Wars. I didn't get that with the last three movies. Yeah. So yeah, it was pretty impressive in that it actually made me very excited for Star Wars again.
James.
Yeah, I think pretty much the same. I mean, it's the first time I've been interested. And as I think, as I said before, I'm never quite sure whether it's that I am really excited about seeing a new Star Wars or whether it's that wanting to sort of see it and as a sort of like an echo chamber to your younger self and sort of placing it and trying to marry it with the old films, you know, that I suppose nostalgia. I don't know which it is yet, but I mean, it looks pretty faithful. I mean, whether it's any good, we'll see. I like the fact that they have made a real effort to get this right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in a sense, one could argue maybe the last three, if this is any good, was pivotal to make this good. They needed to see how not to do it to work out how to do it. Because it does feel that everything in this is reactionary almost to what people don't want. It's very tied in to how to make this work.
Yeah. I think with the last three, and I think this goes back to what I said the other week, I think the only one that feels connected to the other films is the Phantom Menace, and I think that's because of the setting at the beginning. Once you get into later stages of the film, then it starts becoming disconnected, and then you move on to the subsequent movies, and because there doesn't seem to be a connection with what comes later on for us, what happened previously. But here there is, because you've got the physical side of it, and I think with the new trilogy, as they called it at the time, you've got these vast, as you're saying, the overuse of the CGI, the vast CGI city on the capital of the Republic, and the various other CGI elements that are used. But you know, the city in particular is a massive CGI production, which doesn't feel like Star Wars, even though it's straight out of the graphic novels and novels. It doesn't feel like Star Wars. Whereas setting having the desert planet, I assume it's Tatooine in the new movie, but I don't know, it is a desert planet. And same with the Phantom Menace. By setting it there, it feels like Star Wars. But where this one differs is that, as Brian says, it's not full of CGI. There are we see a crashed model. Now it seems to me that that's a very OTT mock-up. So it seems to be a model that is then painted with CGI, or digitally painted, I should say, for the shot that follows it from the film of a crashed TIE fighter. It just feels like a real film and not... It feels like a real experience is going to be had by everyone who goes to the cinema to watch that film. It's a strange excitement. It's difficult to quantify.
Makes you feel like a kid again.
There is that, but I don't think that is what it is. There is that excitement, but I don't think that... It feels like there's something tangible about the movie. And again, we're getting into what we got into a few weeks ago with this discussion about CGI and reality. But it does seem as though, because we've seen all these props and stuff, which, you know, everyone's seen the making of, I should imagine, of the Phantom Menace, and you've got those behind-the-scenes shots of Ewan McGregor and Liam Neeson and Ray Park just dancing around this big green room.
But there was hard sets as well. I mean, I think a lot of this comes down to who you're marketing to and who your audience is, and how you want to market to them. Mm. With the Phantom Menace and that and the ilk, they were trying to promote to a new generation of Star Wars fans, and they were using promotional techniques which showed how cinema had advanced and what wondrous exciting things they could do. So the focus was more on the green screen. It was seen at the time as not a bad thing. It was to say, look what marvelous things we can do with just this.
And that was
their approach. There was a lot of model work in there. There's a few documentaries, I think, on YouTube which try and push this, that it wasn't just green screen. In the same way that people who watch Thunderbirds or Go will assume so much of that is CG, where there's a lot of model work in there before it goes through to CG. But with this new trilogy, it is predominantly being aimed, I would say, more at getting the approval of the original Star Wars base.
Yes.
So the push is to show the models, to show the prosthetics, to show the full ships. And I agree with you; they have actually made more of an effort. I think there's no doubt this time to go down that route. But it makes you wonder, because I mean, you look at Abrams with the Star Trek franchise, where there isn't that much. Well, I'd say there's the spirit of the original show visually, in say the costumes. They're not looking to adapt the aesthetic of the original show. While here, if you look at things like, there's a clip of Leia with her costume, and it's a very 70s feel to that costume, the browns, the lapel, that they're trying to get that aesthetic of 1977.
Hmm.
1970 to 1983, or however you want to put it. And so I think sometimes it depends on what they're marketing and who they're marketing at as to how the process of adaptation works. A lot of people will say it's always about trying to capture the original perfectly, you know, that faithfulness. But I think it depends on who they're marketing to. And if you're not marketing to the people who like the original movie, like with the last trilogy, then you're not going to do that. You're going to market and make it a brand new experience. But this feels marketed to say, we are faithful to the original Star Wars here. Mm. And so that's where this show, these making ofs are doing just that, aren't they?
Okay.
So, I mean, Doctor Who does the same. You know, come the 50th anniversary, 50th anniversary was to say, hey, look how much we respect the roots of the 50 years of this show. So, you know, you get the trailers, you have that wonderful trailer, you know, with all the doctors within it because that's what they were there to say. They weren't there to say, hey, we're so far removed from the new show, we're doing exciting new things. We're saying, hey, we're an anniversary here. Look how wonderful this show was. So the focus is on the past. So it depends on who you're marketing to. And it's probably something Twitter probably doesn't think about enough.
Yeah, Twitter, deal with it. Okay, it's that time, guys. recommendations time. And kind of sticking in the same sort of area, really. I have to, and you know, I have given this a lot of thought, and I've seen the movie, and there are weaknesses to it. This is not a movie that is anywhere near as bad as the reviews are saying. I don't care whether they're newspaper reviews or whether they are the reviews on Rotten Bleeding Tomatoes or whatever. There isn't a single person left the cinema screening alongside me a week, 10 days ago, following Terminator Genesis, that left disappointed. It is easily better than the last two, Terminator Salvation and Terminator... what was the third one called? Terminator 3. you can't really... obviously, it's not going to be better than the original, and Terminator 2 was such a triumph that to say it's better than Terminator 2 is insane. It sits alongside those two films really well. It does that thing that we were talking about earlier on, about the Daleks going back in time and rewriting their own history. It does that both in a narrative sense and in a real-world sense as well. And you know, I don't want to give too much away about it. Matt Smith is in it, and I'm not going to tell you what he does, but he's good in it. And Emilia Clarke from Game of Thrones as Sarah Connor, she's good. Now, there's an interesting turnaround because obviously in the original film, she's the doorway for the into the narrative, which isn't the case here. That's Kyle Reese. He gets wrong-footed just as the audience does, and the really great thing about this film, however, is Arnold Schwarzenegger, who, and this may surprise some of you, but he actually acts, and he's really good in his new kind of senior Terminator role. So, you know, ignore what you've heard or read about this movie online or in the papers or whatever, and just go and see it, because it does a really good job of reviving the franchise, while at the same time, if necessary, closing it. So that is my recommendation, Terminator Genesis. Who would like to get a recommendation now?
Mm-hmm. Who would?
Cold silence.
Brian, your turn.
Oh, my turn. Yeah, thanks. Jerk. I honestly am still making my way through Fringe, which I have already recommended. Mm-hmm. Still very good. I still recommend it. I'm toward the end of season 4 right now. But aside from that, I've really just been watching other things I've recommended before, just because I'm in the mood for them, such as The X-Files and so on. So I will kind of get outside the realm of actual stories and movies to watch, and I'll go into two different realms. I'm going to skip to YouTube. And for anybody who is into comic books or wanting to get into comic books, I'm going to recommend a YouTube channel called NerdSync Productions, which has a series called Comic Misconceptions, hosted by a guy named Scott Nicewander. And it's really interesting because there's lots of things that we think we know about comics just because they're the perceived reality that we all share. But he goes and he kind of digs deep and he finds kind of like the real kind of origins of certain things that we think we know, and gives us a grand history of certain characters or certain events or certain items from the comic book world and so on. And they're really neat. They're short, maybe about 8 to 10 minute long episodes. Lots of information packed in there and lots of useful information, including episodes on characters which I'm not particularly keen on, like Superman. I will have watched a handful of them and I found them very interesting. And I don't really read Superman comics. The last movie did nothing for me, kind of thing. But this little episode was rather cool. So yeah, I would recommend that. Okay. And aside from that, I would skip into the music world. If anybody's looking for some cool, fun music to listen to, I would go ahead and give They Might Be Giants a try. And the reason I'm saying that is because this year they brought back their Dial-A-Song service, which was something they started in the 80s, which was literally dial John Flansburgh, which is one of They Might Be Giants, dial his home phone number, and you would get an answering machine, which each week played a new song that they had written specifically for that service. It was incredible. It was great. It was a great way to promote themselves, you know. And that thing ran up until I think like 2000, 2004, something like that. And then they kind of ended that, and then it went to an online kind of service, and they brought the phone number back again. But now, this year, there's a subscription service called Dial a Song Direct, and every week you get a brand new song. Rather than just being a home answering machine recording, it's a proper song. And so far, part of the service has culminated into their newest album, Glean. So the service is kind of also promoting their new work, which this year, due to the Dial a Song service, they're releasing two adult albums and one children's album because of it. But yeah, They Might Be Giants are a lot of fun. It was They Might Be Giants were created by John Flansburgh and John Linnell way back in the 80s in New York. And now they've got a full band going on. And I don't think I've ever seen another band have as much musical output as these guys. It's like they're a writing factory. They just don't stop. They release music in a multitude of ways. This Dial a Song service of this year is just one of many online outlets that they've had for music outside of their regular albums. So yeah, they're a particular favorite band of mine. So I would recommend them to anyone, give a listen to. And if you haven't checked them out, or if you have, or if you've lost touch with them, get back into them.
Okay. Okay, James, recommendations quickly.
I would recommend, I've been recommend two things. I will recommend, there's an anime I've been watching that's currently that's on Netflix called Terror and Resonance, which came out, I believe, last year, which is just a very smart and beautifully animated tale about Tokyo under a sort of terror siege and how it all plays out. And it's just it's only 11 episodes. It's a full story. And if you've got Netflix and you're in the UK, I would really recommend watching that. It's very, very good. The other thing I will recommend is what I mentioned earlier, the Dalek Time War thing we were talking about. It's the Dalek that time forgot. And it's a CG YouTube fan video, which is beautifully done. And I can't remember if I've ever got to the end of it, if I'm maybe so terrible. But it's really nice. It'll be in the show notes. And I'd recommend that if you like Daleks and you like the idea of mix and mashing eras, it is at the very least a very smart approach to mix and mashing eras. So do watch that.
Okay. Excellent recommendations there, guys. I think you've got a lot to be going on there, dear listener, until Doctor Who returns, or until we return next week. Thanks very much for joining us. Thanks to James. And also thanks to that other fella, Brian Terranova. Until next time, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to the Cerberus Podcast. The Podcast with a K. With Christian Holland, James McLean, and Brian Terranova.
Lovely jubbly. Nice work there,
Brian,
chaps.
Brian Terranova. How about Brian? They think it's all Nova. It is now.
It is now.
Yeah.
What the hell is that?
Oh, well, it's a well-known British catchphrase.
Is it?
Yeah.
They think it's
There's
all
this guy
over.
Called Kenneth Wolstenholme, who was commentating on the 1966 World Cup final when England beat West Germany 4-2. There were 3-2 up when the crowd came onto the pitch, and he says, there's some people on the pitch, they think it's all over. By the time he said over, Jeff Hurst, who was an England striker, had the ball in the final quarter of the field and just outside the penalty area, launched it into the far top corner diagonally, and as it goes in, he says, it is now.
Nice.
And England won the World Cup, so there you go. And I've never won anything since.